I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Sandra Barnes, professor of sociology of religion and professor of human and organizational development, about her recent book, Live Long and Prosper: How Black Megachurches Address HIV, AIDS, and Poverty in the Age of Prosperity Theology. Sandra, thank you for being willing to do this interview.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. I wonder if we could start off with a kind of a general question. What is a black megachurch? And I wonder if in your answer, if you could address a little bit how it differs from black churches that aren't megachurches, mm-hmm. and then megachurches that aren't black megachurches.
Exactly. The definition of a megachurch is a church that typically has, on average, at least 2,000 adults who are participating in weekend worship service. And so that's kind of the broad definition that's commonly used in research. So by extension, a black megachurch would be a megachurch mm-hmm. that has a predominantly black congregation, a black pastor, mm-hmm. and that reflects worship that reflects worship that will be called has black flavor, okay. or that's indicative of the historic black church's worship experience. And so those three components distinguish the black megachurch from its white counterparts, and the size of the black megachurch distinguishes it from its smaller black counterparts.
Okay, great. How did you get interested in studying black megachurches?
Well, my dissertation work many moons ago focused on urban poverty. And so I was interested in how poor black, white, and Hispanic persons were adaptive and resilient. Mm. And one of the things that emerged from that research on the black poor experience was the role of the black church as an agent of change in poor and working class black communities. And so from that point, I became interested in black religiosity, the black church, relative to the black experience. From that, I kind of transitioned in terms of thinking about the black religious collectives and how they were changing over time. Hmm. And became aware of this large black church phenomena, or the black megachurch phenomena, and the ways in which many of these congregations were serving as agents of change hmm. in urban spaces and then also in suburban spaces. Mm-hmm. So it's really an extension of my interest in the adaptive, resilient nature of minority groups in general and blacks in particular.
I didn't know anything about black megachurches coming into this book. I mean, this is a fairly big phenomenon. I mean, there are a lot of black megachurches.
Well, it's interesting. There aren't as many black megachurches, but because they have so many attendees, they're substantial in terms of the number of members and attendees. So, for an example, most scholarship suggests that there is between 120 and 150 black megachurches. But even in my study, the average attendance base was over 8,000 people.
Wow.
And so you're talking about a substantial number of black persons who are attending these large congregations. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting, although we have these large churches, one of the things that I noticed is that they're often hidden populations, meaning we know about the T.D. Jakes, and we know about Creflo Dollar, and we know about Eddie Lee Long's congregation, but there are so many other black megachurches that we don't hear as much about. And so I was interested in really studying the inside perspective mm-hmm. of the hidden black megachurches that have regional and national and even international acclaim, but we don't hear as much about them the way that we do three or four that tend to be in the news all the time. Mm-hmm. And so again, interestingly enough, black megachurches have been around since the early 1900s, and we have Abyssinian in New York and some black megachurches in the South, but actually the black megachurches were growing disproportionately faster than white megachurches, but we just didn't hear as much about them. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of scholars who've been working on this type of work. Thuma and Travis have written on megachurches in general, and Tucker has written on the black megachurch phenomena. Mm-hmm. But we really didn't have a lot of empirical work on large black churches. And so I was really interested in moving that particular body of literature forward, mm-hmm. and then thinking about some of the very applied aspects or applied implications of Black megachurches especially in poor spaces, in poor Black spaces, in urban spaces, and what they were really doing programmatically in response to social problems in the Black community.
And that kind of takes us to the next question, which is that your book places Black megachurches in the context of prosperity theology. And if I was reading correctly, you suggest on the one hand that the linkage that's typically drawn between Black megachurches and prosperity theology and sort of popular discourse may not be entirely accurate, but on the other hand, there are symbols that are associated with prosperity theology that do show up with some frequency in the Black megachurch discourse. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what prosperity theology is first, and then how you see it actually appearing, becoming evident in the Black megachurch.
Exactly. This whole notion of prosperity theology or health and wealth theology is based on this premise that there are certain things that Christians can do in terms of sowing seeds and positive affirmation that should result in a certain lifestyle, and that lifestyle should reflect wealth, and it should reflect the absence of illness. And so this is your traditional understanding of prosperity theology. And anecdotally, it's been suggested that megachurches in general and Black megachurches in particular have kind of exploded because they're touting this prosperity theology. And so I was interested in whether that was the case for my sample of churches. And so just kind of as a contextual FYI, I focused on 16 Black megachurches, but they were strategically drawn from across the United States. And then also I kind of pulled in website information as well as additional sermons from 25 other Black megachurches to kind of expand such that I would have a pretty decent group of Black churches for this analysis. And I was one of the things I was interested in is this supposed manifestation of prosperity theology. And it was really interesting. There were two churches that I would really characterize as prosperity churches, where there was an emphasis on sowing seeds and positive confession and the rhetoric to suggest that Christians, if we quote unquote do it right, we shouldn't be poor and we shouldn't be sick. But by and large, that was not the case for the majority of the churches in the study. In actuality, many of them held great disdain for prosperity theology and were very critical of prosperity theology. And if you remember, one of the things that I was interested in is prosperity theology in general, but how it and if it connected to social problems. So because prosperity theology focuses on health and wealth, for the health piece, I was interested in HIV/AIDS in the Black community. And for the wealth piece, I was interested in poverty.
Right.
So I'm interested in, number one, whether prosperity theology manifests among the Black megachurches in the study. And if it did or did not, what were the implications relative to HIV/AIDS and poverty? You mentioned earlier the reality that it was evident, although the majority of the clergy, the pastors, rejected prosperity theology very, very clearly, there was what I call prosperity symbolism that manifested among most of the churches. And I'm making a distinction between prosperity theology as kind of an overriding ideology and an overriding foci for the churches and symbolism that suggests persons can acquire wealth, persons can, there are things that people can proactively do to maintain their health, and that the stance is that God can provide the opportunity for people to live a certain lifestyle, but that it's not automatic. And so the pastors were very clear about nuancing their theologies in a very specific way, such that they're distancing themselves from prosperity theology while still acknowledging an omniscient God, an all-powerful God who can do anything. And so I liked the way they were trying to, it was very interesting, the way they were trying to walk a fine line. And so I'm referring to this as prosperity symbolism. I even decided, I was reading some slave narratives, and it was really interesting when you look back prior to even the what we call the inception of organized prosperity theology. Slave narratives included prosperity symbolism, or it included commentary or rhetoric that some people might falsely associate with prosperity theology. Mm. And for me, this illustrated the importance of really being very, very critical when we see certain kinds of stances, or mm-hmm. when we hear certain kind of rhetoric or sermons, being very critical so that we're not automatically lumping or reducing, being very reductionist in our understanding of what that particular clergy person is trying to convey. Right. It also suggested that there has historically been this belief in an all-powerful God who can provide wealth, who can provide safety, and who can fortify people prior to prosperity theology's kind of explosion. Mm. And for me, this was very, very telling and very informative about ways in which we might see similar verbiage. Mm-hmm. We might see similar types emphasis mm-hmm. by pastors mm. who clearly are not prosperity theologists, and mm. they're not prosperity proponents. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the major kind of takeaways from this particular study.
Mm-hmm. Now you, when you're considering factors affecting to what extent Black megachurches respond to those, the health and wealth mm-hmm. issues that you're focused on with HIV, AIDS, and poverty, you make frequent use of the concepts of calling and corner. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by those concepts mm-hmm. And how they influence what a church does in terms of HIV, AIDS, mm-hmm. and poverty? And then do they ever work at cross purposes? Do they ever, you know, is the calling sometimes trump the corner, or the corner trump the calling? I mean, how do they work together?
Very, very exciting concepts for this particular study. And I'm drawing from the calling, I'm drawing on information and literature and research from theology. And by the calling, I'm referring to this lifelong existential vocation that pastors and clergy believe that they have, and that it comes from God, basically. Mm-hmm. So there is this contention that each clergy has this lifelong vocation. Mm-hmm. And because of the central role of the Black pastor, even among Black megachurches, the calling of the pastor often informed, or in some cases was one-to-one, in terms of the calling of the congregation. Mm. And so we have this existential understanding of what the pastor should be doing with his or her life, which folds into or melds into this understanding of what that megachurch, that mm. Black megachurch, should be doing in terms of its mission, its vision. And then the corner is the place where that calling takes place. Mm-hmm. And so I was really, this was a pattern that emerged as I talked to the pastors, as I engaged in participant observation, relative to what they thought their churches should be about and the motivation for their programmatic efforts. Mm-hmm. And so both the calling and the corner informed the kinds of decisions that pastors made relative to HIV, AIDS, and poverty. Mm-hmm. And so I'll give you an example. If for some pastors, the contention is we're called to do certain things. And so for many pastors, they believed we're called to follow the model of Jesus Christ. And Christ was, people rejected lepers, but Christ embraced lepers. And for them, they often, it's very interesting, they often associated leprosy with HIV AIDS in terms of the stigma, mm-hmm. in terms of the way in which people responded to leprosy in the Bible, and the way that in which many people respond to HIV AIDS today. Mm-hmm. And so for those pastors who believe that their calling was associated with modeling this extreme agape-driven love that Jesus showed, those were pastors who were most concertedly involved in programs to respond to HIV AIDS. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, there were a couple of pastors who made it quite clear. If I asked them about their involvement in HIV/AIDS programs, their response was, well, my church is not called to do that. And so at that point, those were pastors who were, in their minds, they were justified in being inactive in HIV/AIDS programs. And so the calling literally was driving what pastors and their churches did or did not do relative to HIV/AIDS programs. By the same token, they're informed by the corner as well, because although they have their notions of the calling, if their churches were located on quote-unquote corners where a disproportionate percentage of people were experiencing HIV/AIDS, then that often fostered programmatic efforts from that black mega church. And so even with pastors who, this is what was so interesting also, even pastors who associated HIV/AIDS with homosexuality and who had concerns about homosexuality, you might say, well, that would prevent them from being involved in from their church being involved in programs to address this social problem. But that was not the case. If their corner dictated that they should be involved, then the corner overshadowed any concerns that the pastors might have about how people contracted HIV/AIDS. And they were much more interested in responding in a proactive, thoughtful way. And this particular finding was important because it calls into question this very prevailing anecdote that the black pastors and black churches are so homophobic that they often get stuck. And when responding to HIV/AIDS, because there were some pastors that made it very clear how they felt about sexual minorities, but that did not prevent them from actually having very, very detailed, very comprehensive HIV/AIDS programs. And then also, many of the pastors really were expanding their understanding of where of HIV/AIDS, and not just suggesting this is a this is quote unquote a pandemic associated with sexual minorities. And so there were very, very nuanced ways of thinking about HIV/AIDS and even poverty. But this notion of the calling in the corner, they informed each other. Because even if many pastors, even if their callings didn't dictate programs in response to HIV/AIDS and poverty, if the corner did, then they still had programs. And so it was really interesting to see kind of that interplay between calling and corner. And to respond to your question, by and large, your last question, corner tended to trump calling, meaning there was a very pragmatic dimension to the thought processes of most of the pastors. They weren't going to be involved in programs that contradicted their calling. But they were very prudent about the reality that given our human resources, given our economic resources, given who we are in this community as a black mega church, if we don't do it, who will? And they were also prudent. It was very common for pastors to say, we cannot wait for the government. We cannot wait for white society to respond to issues in the black community. So we're going to do it. And so it was really, really interesting to see the reality of what the corner meant. Also, because the corner, and this is a concept that was initially used to my knowledge by Drake and Caton many years ago when they were writing about the Chicago churches in black churches in Chicago. They talked about or wrote about this notion of the corner. However, for the black mega church, because of their size and because of increased technology and because of their resources, I contend that the corner moves beyond a physical locale. It moves beyond the neighborhood. While for many, a small black church or a small white church, they're quote unquote working their corner, literally means that 1 to 2 mile block, 2 mile radius around their church. But for these black mega churches, many of the pastors described their corners as entire cities. Or because they had international congregations and because they've planted churches around the country, their corners were regions and they had their corner extended to Africa. If HIV/AIDS was in a certain area. And so it's really interesting, this whole notion of what I write about as a physical, literal corner. And a virtual corner. And the virtual corner is possible because of the resources that Black megachurches have. And so that was really, that whole calling and corner was really a fascinating chapter and a fascinating set of findings that emerged that I really, I mean, of course, I didn't know what to expect, but it was really, really exciting to kind of see that whole notion of how the intangible, this whole notion of the calling, how it informs the tangible or the corner and to ultimately influence the kinds of programs that the Black megachurch is sponsored.
Right.
So very interesting.
You also talk about another factor that plays a big part in Black megachurch responses to HIV, AIDS, and poverty, and that's theology. And you identify several kinds of theologies, including prosperity theology, which we've already talked about, holistic theology, social gospel, and liberation theology. And you also talk about some theological theme, theological emphases, thematic theological emphases, community engagement, intensive discipleship, servanthood, among others. What are some of the influences that lead a Black megachurch to move in a particular theological direction? I want to ask also the influences that might not be as evident for the other churches we talk, the smaller Black churches or the mega churches that aren't Black mega churches, but that may or may not be the case. Why does a Black mega church adopt the theological positions that it ends up doing?
One of the things that I was interested in doing is to think about the way in which HIV, AIDS, and poverty was framed. Meaning, how do the pastors intentionally and purposely understand, think about, present, and package these two social problems such that they resonate with their congregation and they resonate with the community. And one of the factors that emerged was the importance, of course, of theology, because this, whatever the, and of course, theology is connected to their calling, because whatever the biblically based kind of ideological thrust was, then that informed the decisions, it informed the teaching and learning experiences, it informed what the church did, and it also informed what the church did not do. So the pastor's profile was very, very important. And this may seem as if, well, that's to be expected. We know most literature tells us that the Black pastor tends to have much more involvement and much more influence on most Black churches as compared to white pastors in predominantly white churches. So this was not anything new in terms of the influence of the Black megachurch pastor. But what was important was the his or her profile. Meaning, it's much more common. It was much more common that these were formally educated pastors. These are pastors who were well versed, very experienced. Many of them coming out of with a business acumen. Many of them coming out of very successful secular kinds of careers, and so their frames of reference were much broader than they were informed by the Bible, but much broader than that. Also informed by other secular kinds of thought processes, and informed by a very interesting, pretty clear understanding about social problems in the Black community, very, very politically savvy. And so these were the types of characteristics, clergy characteristics, that influenced their theological framework. Me, as an example, the pastors who were older, who came out of the civil rights movement, who were who had attended seminaries as opposed to Bible colleges, who were well read in terms of James Cone and systematic theology. Those were the pastors who tended to have a social gospel liberation kind of theology in terms of their own personal stance. And of course, they were conveying that via teaching and learning and sermons to their congregation. And so you had this, the pastor's profile informing the church's theology, but the pastor's profile was typically much broader and much more extensive than one would imagine. By the same token, if there were pastors who understood or who thought about the social problems relative to let's say, prosperity theology. For them, it was really interesting there for several of them. If they embrace prosperity theology, then prosperity theology informed, of course, their decisions about HIV/AIDS and about poverty, because the contention is if you are a strict adherent to prosperity theology and you contract HIV/AIDS, then God will heal you. Or if you are a strict adherent and you happen to be poor, that there are things that you can do such that you will rise out of poverty. And so for especially one pastor in particular, I remember he, because he was a staunch prosperity pastor, their HIV/AIDS programs, they didn't have HIV/AIDS programs because for him, we don't need HIV/AIDS programs. God will heal people with HIV/AIDS. God will heal poor people if they adhere to prosperity theology and it's and the quote unquote formula that is needed. And again, I'm hopefully not coming across as flip, because I'm not being flip at all, because I try to be as culturally relative as I could be to value the theology that they discussed equally, not thinking about any theology more so than the other. And so it was really interesting, because for prosperity proponents, we don't need programs for HIV/AIDS, because our theology tells us that there is another way, there is a spiritual way that HIV/AIDS can be eliminated. And so that was really something very, very interesting. So the pastor's profile also write about this whole notion of, and we'll talk, I guess we'll talk about it a little bit later, this whole notion of favor. Favor was a very, very important concept that emerged, but it wasn't the traditional way that we think about favor in a prosperity kind of context. And by favor, I'm referring to this belief that Christians who are committed and dedicated to God and dedicated to God's ministry have a special, God is looking out for them. God is looking out for them in a way that God is not looking out for other people, although God wants to look out for all of us in that way. And so it does, it adds this whole dimension of accountability to the potential blessings that God has for God's followers. However, it's not causal. It's not suggesting that, so this is how favor is different from prosperity theology. Prosperity theology in its traditional sense suggests if you do this, then this is going to happen. This notion of favor, this notion of God looking out and God wanting to bless people is correlated. It suggests that God can bless you. God can cure HIV/AIDS. God can cure poverty or remove poverty, but God does not have to. And so it provides, for me, it provides a space for certain kinds of outcomes. And by that I mean, for clergy who embrace this notion of favor, they're still able to acknowledge an all-powerful God in the sense that they're still able to suggest, well, God is all-powerful and God can address these social problems. But if God chooses not to, that does not diminish in any way God's power. So it's a really, really a very, very smart way, I think, of thinking about the potential possibilities for opportunities, the possibilities for wealth, the possibilities for success, the possibilities for reaching one's objectives or goals, no matter what they might be, as well as the possibility that if those things don't happen, it's not a negative. It doesn't disparage who God is at all.
Does that also leave us? Does that leave a space then for the church to act? I mean, God is not going to do everything.
Right. The church is acting in response to God's favor. And the church is acting as in two broad ways: in response to God's favor, and also as a tool for which God's favor can manifest. Meaning, if Christians are living and acting based on God's favor, then they are modeling, and the pastors are models of this favor too. The pastors in the churches are modeling God's favor, meaning they are achieving their goals, whether they be economic or non-economic, because again, the focus was not just on economics, but whatever those goals and objectives are, they are, God is blessing them in that way. They in turn can bless other people. So as individuals and as a collective called the Black Mega Church, God's favor blesses those individuals and those churches, but then they in turn can kind of spread that favor via the corner. And they can also spread the potential for favor via their evangelism and their personal testimony. And so one of the things I write about is the, I contend that the Black megachurch pastors who tended to be very charismatic, again, very successful in a variety of ways, very, very learned, that they were literally modeling the theologies. They were modeling favor such that people could point to say, look at what my pastor has done. Look at what my pastor is doing. And then that kind of provided a very real world example that people could point to and then they could emulate. But it wasn't, it's interesting, this notion of favor, even the various theologies that emerged were not presented as panaceas. For most of the churches. So again, there was always this nuance. There was never kind of a black and white or a very easy reductionist way of thinking about the churches. And it's impossible to really fully write about all the nuances. And so that was not my objective. My objective was to do a few things really well, but it's hard to really capture all of those nuances, but it was really interesting to identify and document some of the nuances, because rarely was there a reductionist kind of way of thinking about theology, of thinking about this notion of favor, of thinking about prosperity symbolism. These were complicated spaces, and these were complicated pastors, and that was something that informs us about this, what we of course are calling this kind of new religious terrain, where no longer is it black and white, no longer can we say people should do this or people should do that. There seems to be this push towards very, very, very critical understanding of what it means to be Christian. And by critical, I don't mean negative. I mean a very thoughtful, a very, very detailed way of thinking about what it means to be Christian, over and above your basic edicts to love everybody and love God, and, you know, love God and lift up Jesus. Beyond that, there's this notion of, and this is the way I like to phrase it, most of the pastors were what I call thinking Christians, where literally they were very comfortable questioning and thinking about and being informed by readings and experiences outside the Bible. They didn't feel as if that somehow they were less Christian, or somehow they were somehow being unfaithful to God by reading Afrocentric work and using that to create programs to attract young black males, those types of things. They were not being unfaithful to God by suggesting we can incorporate certain secular types of programs, certain secular kinds of activities to help respond to HIV/AIDS. I'll give you a perfect example. One of the churches, those churches that had the most comprehensive HIV/AIDS programs, usually the pastors were very educated in terms of HIV/AIDS as a pandemic in the black community. They were very, very, the people who were spearheading the programs tended to either be people who were educated relative to HIV/AIDS, and people who had experienced HIV/AIDS in some way, who had been touched by the pandemic. And so you had this formal education, this informal education that was informing the leadership of people who were responsible for the HIV/AIDS programs. And one of the pastors was speaking about how they transitioned their church into embracing a calling toward responding to HIV/AIDS. very, very urban church. I'm in a poor space. Very traditional church. And by traditional, I mean very in terms of traditional gender roles. Mm. The pastor made it very clear to me that he did not embrace homosexuality, and he did not embrace same-sex marriage. And then the next comment was, but this is what we do, and this is how I transitioned my church into attempting to be inclusive from a love, respect perspective. And so they're walking that fine line in terms of not being inclusive of lifestyle, but trying to be inclusive in terms of their responses to social problems and to creating a space where people could come for the comfort programs. Mm-hmm. Very, very, for this particular pastor, they were not interested in how people contracted HIV/AIDS. Mm. And he talked about how he had to begin with sermons and Bible studies to introduce the church to the congregation to HIV/AIDS programs, and also how they strategically included HIV/AIDS programs because they initially had very extensive drug programs, very extensive programs in response to crack cocaine in their community. So for him, he strategically just took the next step. Mm-hmm. The church had been successful in their drug abatement programs, and so they had already been successful. So he already kind of had buy-in from the congregants and the community about something that was potentially controversial or had been in the past. So the next step would be, let's try this program. And the same pastor wrote about, again, the preaching, the teaching to get the folks ready. But then one of his thoughts was, well, we know that HIV/AIDS quilt was so, it was a way to help people to heal. It was a way to help people put a face, a very human face on HIV/AIDS. And in the larger secular society, HIV/AIDS quilts really helped it challenged us as a nation to move beyond the statistics and move beyond the stigma, etc. And so for this pastor, one of his strategies, in addition to the sermons and the teaching and the preaching, etc., was for their church to create an AIDS quilt in terms of people in the church, people in the community who had passed as a result of HIV/AIDS. And this brought the church together. It also helped to, again, put a face on HIV/AIDS, and it made it very, very difficult for people to say we shouldn't have HIV/AIDS programs when you saw the children and adults and people in the community, their faces on the quilts and their names on the quilt. And so it was a very, very strategic, smart move on his part to really work to cultivate a space where they could ultimately get to very, very comprehensive HIV/AIDS programs. And for this particular church, many people wouldn't even imagine, but they have some of the most comprehensive programs. He refers to them as cradle to the grave. And he's being very, it's a very sobering comment, but he's saying however you get here and whatever your needs are, we're going to try to respond to those needs in a thoughtful way. And that is what their church is supposed to do. Mm. So it's really, really interesting in terms of his description of the process by which this pretty theologically conservative church is involved in what folks would say would be very controversial programs in response to the pandemic. But for my findings, tied it to the church theology, tied to the pastor's calling, to the corner, because on his corner, people were dying. And one of his comments was he could not justify, as a pastor, seeing people around him die and their church not responding to that threat. So really, really interesting in terms of how theology and calling and corner and the pastor's profile, how they all, and even notion of favor, how they all inform these decisions about HIV/AIDS and poverty. Mm-hmm. Because even this notion of favor, for persons who have God's favor, they are challenged then to share that. Mm. They're challenged then to help other people who have not experienced that to understand what they can do to experience that favor as well. Mm. So really interesting.
You mentioned in your response the concept of stigma, and I wanted to ask you about that. And it sounds like, you know, one example of that you gave of dealing with mm-hmm. stigma was this AIDS quilt. I mean, can you talk a little bit about how mm-hmm. you know what kind of resources Black megachurches bring to mm-hmm. to dealing with the stigma of HIV/AIDS mm-hmm. that you know that are special to them.
I mean. Exactly. One of the things that I mentioned, of course, the HIV/AIDS quilt as a strategy mm-hmm. to tap into proven ways to respond in a very positive, proactive way to the pandemic. But one of the things that was very interesting was the going back to this notion of favor and this notion of the calling. Most of the pastors believed that their churches were social forces in and of themselves. And because of their human resources, because of their economic resources, the contention is we are powerful. And because we're powerful and because we are sanctioned by God, then we have the ability to withstand stigma and to respond to stigma. And we have the onus is on us to sometimes be at the forefront. Hmm. One of the pastors mentioned that they're cutting edge. They're on the forefront of responding to social problems like HIV/AIDS. And this particular pastor mentioned that the same way when they first started some of their programs, because usually most of these churches have what's called cafeteria-style programs, where they have a plethora of different spiritual and non-spiritual programs to respond to social problems in their community and for their membership. So literally, as the name suggests, they have the cafeteria, you can choose from a mm-hmm. variety of different programs. And so the HIV/AIDS and poverty programs are just an extension of this cafeteria-style style setup, if you will. And so I'll give you an example. One of the pastors mentioned that they've had an alcohol, Alcoholics Anonymous in their church for years. Yeah. But when they initially started, they experienced stigma. People in the community were saying, if you go over there to that church, that's where all the drunk people go. And then they had a program where they were responding to prostitution. Mm. And so they had already dealt with that stigma. Mm-hmm. And because they had, he used the term, we weathered that storm. Mm. Once they weathered those storms, then responding to HIV/AIDS was just another storm mm-hmm. that they had to weather. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting for pastors like that. The contention is that there is a special... Now, that is something their church is supposed to do. They're literally called to do it. And if they're called to do it, then they should do it. They have to do it, literally. So this notion of the calling it seemed to be a very powerful mm-hmm. force mm-hmm. where folks believe we have to do this. Mm-hmm. And for those pastors, one of the models that continually emerged was the model of Jesus Christ. Jesus was stigmatized. Jesus was misunderstood. Jesus was talked about. And if he dealt with that and he endured, how dare we think that we should not? Mm. And so the way that they framed their responses to stigma were informed by this model of Jesus Christ. We're also informed by this understanding of what it meant to be mega, mm-hmm. meaning we are powerful and our power is coming from God. And these are things that if there's negativity, we have to deal with it. It's really interesting. One of the pastors even spoke about they have extensive HIV/AIDS programs, but that was kind of an end result. They also dealt with issues of inclusivity in terms of sexual minorities, in terms of gender roles for women. Hmm. And for this pastor, even though their church is mega, he wrote about they had a major fallout where they lost half of their membership. So the stigma, there's some very real implications here. So it suggested to me that for pastors who had dealt with stigma, they were not... They weren't foolish mm-hmm. in their understanding about the stigma mm-hmm. and the potential implications. Yet for them, they could not respond in any other way than to move forward. Mm-hmm. And so for that particular pastor that I just mentioned, their, of course, church is still mega. They have about 4,000 members, but they used to have about 8,000 members. And so, of course, that's affected them financially. Mm-hmm. It's also affected kind of his stature among pastors who were conservative the way he used to be. Mm-hmm. But the point is, he suggested now that church is stronger than ever. The programs are stronger than ever because the people who are left there, have most of them have truly bought into the mission of the church. They truly have embraced their theology. They truly are inclusive. Mm-hmm. And so for him, this is the, even though the church experienced very real negative repercussions as a result of stigma, mm-hmm. in many ways, he feels as if they're better for it. Mm-hmm. And so he used the phrase, sometimes God adds by subtraction. And it was so really interesting in terms of some of the phrasing, mm-hmm. and some of the rhetoric that the pastors use to understand or to frame things like stigma, mm-hmm. or to frame and understand the social problems in the Black community and how their churches should respond. Mm-hmm. So stigma was, and one more point about stigma is those pastors whose churches sponsored the most extensive HIV/AIDS programs did not automatically suggest that other churches should follow suit. Hmm. This was so interesting. They suggested that sometimes if a congregation, even if it's a large Black church or a large white church, even if they have the resources, if they have not gone through a resocialization process and really prepared their church and prepared the community and created the infrastructure for comprehensive AIDS programs, they could actually do more harm than good. Mm. And so for the pastors who had kind of weathered these storms associated with stigma and associated with what it took to create these extensive programs, they suggested everybody's not set up for this kind of mission. Make sure you're called to do it. Make sure that you have again, you've prepared your people for it, and make sure that this is something that you're willing to do for the long haul. Mm. For those types of pastors, they suggested, though, that every church can be involved, whether it be a mega church or a small church, a Black church or a white church, but different churches should be doing different things. And so one of the things that I wrote about in this particular book was best practices, because pastors suggested that every church does not have to reinvent the wheel. That there is an important place for alliances, for networks. That there's an important place for some churches can have certain kinds of programs. Other churches maybe should start off just in terms of teaching and workshops and preaching, and then transition over time into other types of more structured activities. Mm. And so that was very, very telling, because these are pastors who had experienced what it took to really respond to HIV/AIDS and poverty in concerted ways, and they were very concerned about churches kind of jumping in there, who were and being ill prepared, mm-hmm. and really doing some damage.
Right. I wanted to ask at least one question, mm-hmm. about the poverty,
yes.
mm-hmm. portion of your book. I got a sense reading it that poverty means a number of things,
mm-hmm, exactly.
to mega churches. I wonder if you could talk about what exactly. does poverty, what does it mean to be poor,
exactly.
in the Black mega
churches? Exactly. It's really one of the things that I noticed was, of course, most of the churches had programs to respond to HIV/AIDS and poverty, but the rationale behind the programs were usually very different, and the nature of the programs were very, very different. In the chapter on poverty, I present it as a poverty as a frame continuum, because my contention is that responding to poverty, whether it be directly or indirectly, was always a part of the programs of all of these Black mega churches in my study. Mm. While that was not the case for HIV/AIDS. Mm. And so the notion of what it meant to be poor was less stigmatized, and their responses tended to be just as nuanced as those for HIV/AIDS, but as I say, coming from a different place. So we could speak about your literal examples of poverty in terms of people who are economically, who do not have the ability to kind of sustain themselves economically, mm-hmm. but we can also speak about people who are poor in spirit, people who do not understand these pastors, people who don't understand the potential favor that they have, such that they do not have to experience various forms of poverty. It was really, one of the things that was quite telling was the tendency for pastors to suggest and to believe that that they had to initially address spiritual poverty. Mm-hmm. They had to initially address the spiritual deficits in people's lives as Christians and as Black people and as humans. And once they had done that, then they could evolve and transition into addressing other economic poverty and addressing the other kind of lived experiences and other behavior that we associate with being poor. And so and then also there was this again nuance or this hook to suggest that everybody's not going to be rich. Everybody should not expect to be rich. God may bless you to be economically stable, but if God does not, that still does not disparage who God is. And so they and part of this whole notion of responding to poverty was some theological motivations, but also very pragmatic, very, very pragmatic in the sense that the pastors were much more critical of making people accountable for their situations. And this was not this whole notion of kind of a romanticized Horatio Algiers kind of story. No, they were suggesting again that if you don't do it, and if we don't do it, we cannot expect the government to do it. We cannot expect white people to do it. These are things that we have to do for ourselves. And so there was this great kind of notion of empowerment and self-efficacy. But at the heart of it, it has to, according to the pastors, it has to come from God first. That God wants people. God, I mean, God does not want anybody to be poor, whether it be poor in spirit, whether it be poor literally. So there is this kind of umbrella of possible favor over us. Yet, everybody's not going to experience it for a variety of reasons. And so they began with the spiritual piece in terms of the contention was people have to be actively engaged in their empowerment. And if people are not going to be actively engaged, then we can't help you. And that this is not, again, some kind of panacea, some kind of pie in the sky. So these were those 14 pastors who were not prosperity proponents. Their contention is it has a spiritual impetus, but this is not pie in the sky. The things that people have to do every day to escape poverty. But poverty, the way they thought about poverty was not, or the way that they were concerned about poverty did not have they weren't as concerned about stigma. They weren't concerned about the whether churches would get involved in programs and do damage. So because poverty has had a historically longer chronic place in the Black community, their programs tended to be, of course, have been in existence longer, but they also were informed by contemporary dynamics. Example, it's very, very common if you read Lincoln and Mamiya, you read Drake and Caton, very common for Black churches to have, let's say, a prison ministry. And we know the economic connections between prison for families who have incarcerated parents and incarcerated adults, etc. And so it's not a surprise that Black mega churches would have prison ministries. The twist on it would be, well, prison ministries in general, but then prison ministries specifically for families where females are incarcerated, where moms are incarcerated, or ministries where it's associated with Girl Scouts. So girls who are Girl Scouts whose parents or one parent is incarcerated. So you had these interesting, I call them hooks, where the churches were being very, very creative and very, very thinking outside the box in terms of how the types of poverty abatement programs that they sponsor. Very, very keen on this notion of buying property and people having homes and you know, the house as a form of wealth. And that was one of the ways in which I believe that people have confused many Black churches with kind of prosperity proponents, because it was very common for churches to for pastors to write about and to talk about the various kinds of workshops that their churches sponsor about how to manage your debt, how to get out of debt, how to purchase a home, how to own your own business. And for these pastors, they associated that with empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
But for some persons outside of that space, I could see how they could misconstrue that
mm-hmm.
to be an emphasis on prosperity, mm-hmm. an emphasis on economic attainment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the differences or the distinctions that I was able to kind of uncover
mm-hmm.
by really getting in there and talking to pastors and going to their services and going to their activities to really see the impetus behind their poverty programs. And that for the vast majority of them, this was not about prosperity theology. This was about pragmatism.
Helping
it was about
exactly.
And the contention is that we are one of the big points is that God has enabled us to experience these quote unquote blessings. Other people can experience them as well. And we're going to show you how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another piece that I thought was very interesting, though, is for the pastors realized that when we do this, yes, we are following our calling and we're empowering the corner, but we're also improving our church. Because when we help people, they will be indebted to our church. They will come to our church. They will tithe at our church. They will volunteer at our church. Their children will come to our church. Hence, our church will grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had that connection there, meaning the pastors seemed to be very, 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 very clear and comfortable about their callings and about their programmatic efforts. But they also were very smart
mm-hmm.
in terms of understanding what it meant to grow a church.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to their profiles, where many of them had business backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them have been they know how to engage they know how to develop organizations. They
mm-hmm.
know how to grow a business.
Mm-hmm.
And those types of models were then brought in and nuanced
mm-hmm.
for a Christian space.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure, since I think we're running a little bit low on time, I wanted to make sure to ask you this particular question.
Mm-hmm.
This will be our final question. It's kind of a long one. but just to set it up, throughout the book, Live Long and Prosper, you draw comparisons between the black megachurch struggles with HIV, AIDS, and poverty and the civil rights struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the book, or towards the end of the book, you point out that those least affected by HIV, AIDS, or poverty are being asked to care about those most affected, which
mm-hmm.
is a problem because a lot of times people,
mm-hmm.
if they're not affected by something, it's kind of hard for them to do something about it. And here you talk about the civil rights movement as an example that was able to bridge this gap,
mm-hmm.
to bring people who didn't seem to be directly affected together with people who
mm-hmm.
were. And work together to bring about change. So you even suggest that a black megachurch-led social movement might be called for to do something similar. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the similarities and differences that you see between the civil rights struggle and these
mm-hmm.
these struggles that black megachurches are involved with as far as HIV and AIDS. And then what do you see this black megachurch-led movement looking like?
Mm-hmm.
One
of the things that's clear is black megachurches, white megachurches, these large churches have substantial human resources and economic resources. And one of the things that emerged, at least for this sample of 16 churches that I focused on, was their very, very extensive and pretty impressive set of programmatic efforts in response to HIV, AIDS, and poverty in terms of education and in terms of their reach, if you will, in the broader community. So one of the things that I was thinking about was, well, what is the next step potentially relative to these large black churches? If we see that some of the churches had clinics, grocery stores.
Mm.
So we're talking about some pretty impressive kinds of community engagement efforts. What's the next step? Can we expect to see a black megachurch run hospital?
Mm.
can we see the black megachurches coming together? There are some alliances across megachurches, and many of the black megachurch pastors, of course, know each other. But to my knowledge, we don't have the 120 to 150 black megachurches. There is no network where you could say, well, 70 or 80% of them get together on a regular basis to and work together to address a major issue like HIV, AIDS, or poverty. So my contention is, if something like that could be done, even because again, we don't want to go outside the box. Even if we said for 20% of those churches, that would be substantial. Mm. Remember that about for the churches in my sample, we're talking about each of them an average of 8,000 members. So even if you had 10, 15 of the churches coming together in terms of an alliance, what would that mean relative to what I'm calling a movement, relative to in terms of addressing social problems, in terms of being at the forefront of certain kinds of change? And we know, of course, this is a different day relative as compared to the civil rights movement. And but to me, there the black megachurch and its increase is relative is a result of the new day. So we would, while we would not expect a black megachurch-led social movement to look like the civil rights movement, there are some commonalities in terms of charismatic pastors, in terms of people who believe that they are existentially led to do something they wouldn't do on their own. And so you have for the churches in my sample, just as many of them had large percentages of working class and poor members. The same types of folks who were involved in the civil rights movement, you had middle class people, just like you had in the civil rights movement. So you have this diverse mixture of people. You have people who potentially have this existential understanding about what they should and should not be doing with their lives. You have the charismatic leadership. So you have these certain factors in place that I contend are ripe for concerted efforts to respond to social problems, and not just to respond, but concerted efforts to proactively be at the forefront of social change. This is not a surprise, because for most of the pastors, they have already been concertedly at the forefront proactively of social change, especially in terms of HIV AIDS programs. One of the reasons that I was thinking about this is, of course, now we have the civil rights movement is written about in certain ways. But we know, my contention is, every black church was never involved in the civil rights movement. Every pastor was never involved in the civil rights movement. Every black person was not involved. And so, but the people who were made a dramatic change in terms of space. Of course, we know that they did not do all that they wanted to do, but the no one can argue that they did not make, that the civil rights movement was not very, very important in terms of not only providing, changing the life chances of black people, but changing the life chances of other minorities, of white women, of physically handicapped, etc. So the point that I'm trying to make is, there should not be, we should question arguments that suggest that all black megachurches need to be inclusive, or all black megachurches need to do this or to do that in order to engage in a social movement. My contention is, in any social movement that you've that we've had in historically, you've never had 100% buy-in, but people still moved forward with that movement. This suggests that, given the human and economic resources in black megachurches, something like that is not far-fetched. And so that was my point, that it's not far-fetched. And given what some of the pastors are already doing, I would not be surprised to see concerted efforts in terms of an alliance. Or I would not be surprised to see a black megachurch purchasing a hospital that's been closed in a poor urban area and opening that hospital again. I would not be surprised to see more black megachurch-led grocery stores. Those are things that would not surprise me, given what has emerged in this particular study. And but my contention is, this social movement would look, would reflect some of the characteristics of the civil rights movement, but would also be reflect this contemporary religious, a new religious environment in which we're living in, where people, where black people who are part, I contend, who are part of many of the mega churches are expecting more of themselves. Mm. They're expecting more of their churches. They're expecting more of society. Mm. Particularly in notion of this notion of favor. Mm. So they're expecting more from their God, which would lend itself to some really transformative types of programs, some really transformative types of activities. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the movement would take the form of marches, mm-hmm. or which again would not be a problem, but I'm suggesting that you'd find more creative mm-hmm. ways of trying to affect change. Mm-hmm. It's very one example I'll give you is that a significant number of the pastors were very politically active mm-hmm. in terms of congresspersons, a couple of senators, a couple of superdelegates during the Obama administration. So people who are a part of the process, and then also people who are outside of the process critiquing the process. Mm-hmm. And so I would expect this movement to have a variety of different legs. Mm. Alden Morris writes about this whole notion of charisma that was so important in the civil rights movement. One of the importance of charisma was very evident among not only the black mega church pastors that I studied, but even in terms of their lay leaders, even in terms yeah. of this notion of what does it mean to be quote unquote a Christian, where we're supposed to live a certain way. We're supposed to have a certain presentation of self. And so this routinization of charisma, I'm suggesting, would not weigh down a movement, but would actually catapult mm-hmm. a movement. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that one of the critiques that I make, and by critiques, I mean one of the limitations, I think, of the current black megachurch context is an absence of an alliance, mm-hmm. of a major national alliance that where you're getting a substantial number of pastors or clergy representatives and lay persons who are coming together with a national agenda. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But my contention is that's probably something that would happen sooner rather than later. And that would be indicative of kind of the first steps towards a black mega church led social movement.
Right. Which has some similarities to the civil rights movement, but we're, as you say, we're in a different time.
Exactly, different time. Different, yeah. And we have some extenuating circumstances that require some require a critical eye. Meaning, many of the issues that were so apparent in the civil rights movement, we have to rethink something as basic as huge change. We now have a black president. Mm. So the huge literature on colorblind racism. Mm. Race means something different now. Mm. Many black people view race is different. Mm. How many white people view race is different. Even something like that would have to be thought about mm-hmm. relative to networks and alliances, mm. relative to what is considered a social problem in the black community. Mm. Because for some folks, they may contend, what do you mean we're still having a problem with poverty in the black community? We've got a black president. Everything is fine. And so and I'm not being too reductionist. What I'm saying is the day is much more, our space now is much more complicated. Mm-hmm. And how black people and white people and poor people and non-poor people and how we're interacting has gotten a lot more complicated. Hence, what a movement would look like.
Yeah.
Would have to be more complicated because for most movements there has to be a critical mass of disenfranchised people. Mm. Do we have that? Mm. And if we don't have that, do we have a critical mass of people who may have experienced God's favor who aren't disenfranchised, but whose calling mm-hmm. and whose theology and whose corner concerns cause them to come together mm. anyway? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was really kind of stepped back and I thought about. to say, well, is this possible? Do we see this coming? And can it happen in light of what of some of the findings that emerged in this particular study?
Right.
And I'm contending that the elements are there. The certain types of programs, certain types of decisions, certain types of Black mega church activities already suggest that that is quite doable. One of the things that I write about is if there's going to be a Black mega church social movement, who's going to lead it? And that's a major issue when you think about the fact that these are pastors who whose churches rival some businesses and pastors who are successful in their own right. Who's going to how would that leadership look? Meaning, would it be one person or one major focal person the way that we had MLK? Probably not. Would it be a some type of committee? Who's going to do that? That in and of itself would have to be ironed out.
Right.
And that could be a potentially daunting process given the profiles of most Black megachurch pastors.
Right.
So that's just one example. But by and large, this particular book was very, very, for me, bodes well to the Black religious response to these two social problems. Again, it's not suggesting a panacea, nor is it suggesting, and I always make it clear, I'm not suggesting that Black megachurches are doing all they should do.
Hmm.
But by the same token, my contention is none of us are doing all we should do.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, what are churches doing, and what are their, how can we take what they're already doing to use strategically to be modeled by other churches, whether they're mega churches or whether they're not, whether they're, you know, whatever the racial makeup of that church is. What can we learn from the large Black church that will help us to respond to not only HIV/AIDS and poverty, but other social problems in the Black community and outside the Black community?
Thank you. Thank you very much for this conversation, Sandra.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Again, I've been talking with Sandra Barnes, Professor of Sociology of Religion and Professor of Human and Organizational Development, about her book, Live Long and Prosper, How Black Megachurches Address HIV/AIDS and Poverty in the Age of Prosperity Theology, recently published by Fordham University Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.